All right, we are back with Dr. Andy Jones of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you.
And we are discussing television, specifically the invention of television 75 years ago this very month in San Francisco. I know that this is something that you've been reading up on.
It is. You know, you mentioned San Francisco. It's interesting to me that this really is a Western phenomenon. When you think about television, as someone who grew up on the East Coast, I always thought of it coming out of New York and the East, necessarily.
Right.
But to think that the idea for television as we know it today came out of a teenager's thoughts as he was plowing his farm in Utah, and that it was really born in neighborhoods that KDBS listeners know well in San Francisco, really changes our entire perspective about where we think this kind of cultural phenomenon originates.
It is amazing to me to think that at the base of Telegraph Hill, where Coit Tower is in San Francisco, and by coincidence, you know, is two blocks away from the KGO studios at the present time, the building is still there at Green and Sansom Street, where, yes, Philo Farnsworth, at age 21, on September 7th, to be exact, 1927, broadcast for the first time an image using a purely electronic means of sending a signal. Guys had been working before this with mechanical television, with a complicated device using a disc with holes cut into it in a spiral. They were able to sync up the holes, and if everything was synced up exactly right, you could shine a light through it and then sync it up to your other machine and thereby get an image. But they were very bad images.
It was like a really fast, what are those things called, picture viewers? You know, those toys that kids have where you kind of advance the wheel and you move on to the next image. From what I saw, if you just advance it really quickly, then it almost seems like a moving image, but right. Still seems certainly awkward and pedestrian compared to what Farnsworth was coming up with in the 20s.
Now, interestingly, about 6 months ago, my sound engineer, Mr. Edward McMillan here, asked me about this Wired magazine article about the man that invented television. I said, what do you mean, the man who invented television? He said, well, the article's about the guy that invented TV. And I said, well, TV doesn't have an inventor. There's a lot of guys that were involved in inventing TV. And I went to think, and I said, the guy's name's Vladimir Zworykin is the name that comes to mind. Well, of course, he then gave me the Wired magazine article, and I was disabused of this notion. It was actually, Zworykin does have a role to play, but it actually is much more complicated.
He was more of a spy, wasn't he? Sent over from by Sarnoff. Am I remembering this right?
Well,
sent over to wasn't it Zworykin who was sent over to check out what Farnsworth was up to?
Yes. The story is that as you mentioned, Farnsworth is age 14, plowing a potato field. He's interested in radio. He has limited chances to be educated because he's, you know, in a rural high school up in, I guess, at that time they just moved from Utah to Idaho. He was trying to learn what he could. The house they bought had a bunch of magazines from popular radio-type magazines. He devoured them. He read about Einstein's theory of, like, the photoelectric effect and read about Marconi and things. And got thinking about radio and what its potential was and electricity, all these things that could be done. And while plowing the field, it occurred to him that the lines on the field, you could use similar lines. If you scanned across line after line, you could send an image. With a little more than a good idea and some self-taught, you know, some knowledge that he had, I guess he attended BYU for a year but had no money, he convinced a couple of fundraisers that, by God, he could do it. He's like 18 years old and convinces them, that, you know, I think I can do this. And they listen to him, they listen to his pitch, and they invest in him. It's amazing. But Zworykin also had the idea that he could do television about the same time.
And he was really well educated, though, wasn't he? He was older, and he came over from Russian, and he had a PhD.
I think he did. He certainly studied with the universities in St. Petersburg and in France. Came from a wealthy family, and when he came to America, he got hooked up with, I think it was Westinghouse, or at that time there was a consortium that was put together by the government after World War II involving RCA, Westinghouse, I think AT&T, and I think United Fruit, because they were doing some things with banana boats and like radio communications.
Uh-huh.
And this sort of this conglomerate set to work developing a monopoly, which they then did splendidly. Sorkin wanted to do television, and as this later patent fight is a very dramatic story involving Sorkin claiming that in 1923 he'd patented television, but he didn't have a workable model. He had some ideas, and he was a good inventor, but it was Farnsworth in 1927 who really put together a camera tube that was so good that it really was the basis for the guts of every television camera that's come along since.
Yeah, Sorkin, as an academic, had many of the theoretical ideas right, but was never able to put together that first prototype that actually worked. And I think that one of the differences there was the inspiration that Farnsworth got from those early stories of the Wright brothers and of Edison,
right,
of the single American inventor who says, I think I can figure this out.
Yes.
An independent mind figuring it out on his own, and then leading to wealth and fame. And he was kind of combating there this more corporate model that we know today,
yes,
where RCA and others were setting up these huge labs of scientists who were working together. And so it was really not only an advent of the era of television, but kind of a change in the whole paradigm of what it means to invent something, to bring something into being.
The Wired magazine goes into the fact that there is this great American, what's more American than the idea of a Thomas Edison or a Robert Fulton or even
a Thomas Jefferson or
right,
a Ben Franklin.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, great tradition in America of men that just tinkered and came up with a great idea, and by God, it was a better mousetrap and the world beat a path to their door. But unfortunately, the realities, as exemplified in the Farnsworth case, were that large corporations were putting together laboratories that were going to dominate patents. It just so happens that Farnsworth built a prototype in 1927, refined it by 1930, and was able to get the patents that Sorkin had been trying to get, but was basically not granted because he didn't have a working model. Actually, there was a commemoration of this event in San Francisco, where Farnsworth's sisters, age 92 and 94, were there. Farnsworth grandsons were there. And it was really neat to hear them talk about, their grandfather,
right,
their brother, what he had accomplished. But the most moving statement was made, which we have on tape for you, by a man named Ted Lilienthal, who at that time was a 19-year-old physics student. And, let me let him tell the story.
Back in 1929, I was at Galileo High School, and I was taking a course in physics. And I was teamed up with another guy to do experiments. And got to know each other quite well, and I guess after 2 or 3 months, he said to me one day, "Ted, have you ever seen television?" I said, "What the hell is television? Never heard the word, it didn't exist." He said, "My brother is a television inventor and engineer, and he sends pictures through the air." I said, "That's impossible." He said, "No, it's not, that's what we're doing." He said, "You want to see it?" And I said, "Yes, you can pull my leg." He said, "Well, come down Saturday," and I came down to this building, "and we'll show it to you." So I came down and went up through the same stairs there that are still there, and he introduced me to Fowler, who was then about in his early 20s, I believe. And we chatted for a while, and he said, we'll put on a show for you. So we called Oakland, where the transmitter was, and they put on a picture about Mary Pickford. And by God, the picture was just absolutely wonderful. I couldn't believe my eyes. I couldn't believe this was coming through the air from someplace else. So I went home later in the day, and I told him my dad what I had seen. He said, "That's impossible. How can they send pictures through the air?" I said, "Don't tell me it can't be done. I just saw it." So he was a stockbroker at that time, and he said, "I'm going to check with some of my friends." And sure enough, a good many of them were backing Philo at the time. But this was quite an experience, and I never will forget that. And I felt all my life that this non-recognition that's occurred of a man that is just as famous, should be just as famous as Thomas Edison, never is known by anybody. I have quizzed a lot of people. In fact, I was on a cruise a couple of years ago, and the vice president of CBS was at the table at lunch, and I asked him who the inventor of television was. He hadn't the vaguest idea who it was. But the changes in the world that have occurred through television, education, and other ways, are just remarkable. And I feel very proud to have met him at that time.
Certainly a moving thing to hear from a man who is an actual eyewitness to history.
Absolutely. And that idea about Farnsworth not getting the recognition that he deserved. That, I mean, people who know the story, and of course, Evan Schwartz tells this story in his...
We should put a plug in.
Yeah. The Last Lone Inventor, A Tale of Genius, Deceit, and the Birth of Television. This idea of deceit and of Farnsworth never getting the recognition that he deserved, that's really become the kind of the controlling metaphor of this story for people who know about Farnsworth, that although he was the genius, although he had the patent first, because of he was fighting all these RCA lawyers, he was fighting some underhanded companies, and with the bad luck of World War II beginning when it did,
right,
he was never really able to capitalize on his great invention.
Right.
And now people today, you know, don't know his name.
Yeah, unfortunately, the rags to riches Horatio Alger story that should have been doesn't materialize because at RCA, David Sarnoff is determined that they're not going to pay any patent royalties for anybody else's invention, and they're going to invent it themselves, damn it. He sends working out at one point, basically as an industrial spy,
yeah,
it seems in the end, because working goes, and they were very open at the lab. They actually built the camera for him in stepwise fashion, showing him every inch of the way how you would do it from scratch. And they must have known. They weren't that naive as to realize that he wouldn't go out and try and use this to his advantage. But what they thought was that, you know, they were going to get the patent. They'd be protected by American law with the patents. RCA would come around, they would cut a deal, and they would work together profitably. And by God, that's what should have happened.
Absolutely.
But RCA was determined not to pay patent royalties. They put together a team called the Get Around Farnsworth Squad. Zworkin himself was no slouch, and he and his team were making breakthroughs. But in the end, they went to court, and all the while, you know, it's really sad that, you know, that RCA was like the Microsoft of its time.
Exactly. I think a lot of people at home are thinking about Microsoft and the sort of tactics that have been used to either squelch competition or to buy out those smaller companies that,
right,
seem to have a good idea.
Right.
And to kind of just, you know, fold that into Windows or Internet Explorer or whatever the Microsoft product or application would be.
Well, you know, this book, Evan Schwartz's book, and another book, The Boy Genius and the Mogul, The Untold Story of Television by Daniel Stashower, which are virtually identical books,
yeah,
almost identical, go into this, but they soft pedal, I think, the fact that the David Sarnoff, Farnsworth was not the only body lying in the tracks, you know, behind Sarnoff. He did pretty much the same thing to Edwin Howard Armstrong, the man that invented FM radio.
Oh, I didn't know that.
By basically deciding that if FM comes along, well, then who's going to want my AM sets? And, it, you know, it is a better technology. So he basically fought Armstrong. Armstrong finally said to hell with him and tried to build his own national network of FM stations. And due to chicanery and legal battles, Sarnoff was able to get FM redefined. He was also able to basically not pay Armstrong anything when they decided, well, television, the audio part of television uses FM.
Right.
And Sarnoff decided that, well, we're just not going to pay him for it, and got away with it.
And he got away with that with Farnsworth for a long time, and the television, before eventually the Farnsworth's patent was recognized, right?
Well, we could have had television. I mean, our parents could have been watching television in the mid-30s.
Right.
Had RCA just said, okay, this guy's camera's really good, we have to honor his patent, we're going to pay him some royalties. So Zworkin's team actually had produced a better television through some accidents and some luck and some hard work. They'd produced a better actual TV set, but they couldn't get around the fact that Farnsworth camera was still the state of the art.
Right.
But had they just cut a deal and gone forward, we'd have had television in the 30s. But I think Sarnoff's idea also was that, why do I want to rush that technology along? The longer I can delay it, the longer I can not pay royalties. Patents expire after 17 years. Farnsworth was given the patent in 1930, which meant that his patents would expire in 1947. And I think that, you know, a lot of our listeners perhaps don't realize, but television really took off in 1948.
Right.
I don't think it's a coincidence.
And Sarnoff also was the king of radio, right? That he was making a ton of money off of radio, which he pretty much controlled.
Yes.
And so that's another reason it slowed down the production of this newfangled television because he was already in charge of the existing media when it comes to the existing electronic media.
And you probably know more about this than I do, and you talk about this on your show, Poetry and Technology, that I've heard a lot of people claim that, you know, Microsoft, despite the claims of being the great innovator, is actually holding everybody back right now.
Well, there's a lot to that. And part of it is it's the same sort of idea, that Microsoft does have the monopoly when it comes to operating systems and Office applications. So if someone has a new idea, a new approach, then it certainly is not in Microsoft's interest to promote the new idea. And a lot of people who espouse Linux talk about this, that the Linux users are able to work together as a community, pushing forward a product for the product's sake, rather than to make a bundle of money.
Yeah.
And so, Microsoft certainly feels more threatened by Linux users than most of the programmers and inventors who are working in garages, whether it be in Silicon Valley.
Right. Like the lone inventor, we love to celebrate, you know, Jobs and Wozniak working in the garage. But when it comes out to battling corporate America, it doesn't always come across so David versus Goliath-y.
Right. Well, Goliath usually wins.
Well, he usually
does. Goliath has more lawyers. Yeah.
These days, Goliath would win because his lawyers would be fighting the battles for him.
Right.
But, it's interesting that there's a double whammy involved in this, that Farnsworth, in the end, by the late 30s, Farnsworth tries to go to England and fight RCA over there, allying with John Logie Baird, who'd been working on mechanical television. Unfortunately, Baird and Farnsworth cut a deal to go head-to-head against RCA, and then all of his equipment burns up in a fire.
Yeah.
He's actually, the Nazis were broadcasting, I believe, the Berlin Olympics using Farnsworth's cameras. So he had a chance of actually making a lot of money. And I believe in 1940, they decided, RCA capitulated and signed an agreement to pay him $1 million,
right,
and to license him. But at that moment, World War II was the second part of the twin punches that knocked poor Philo Farnsworth out of the box. World War II intervenes, all commercial production of electronics ceases for the duration of the war, and he knew at that point, he knew he was finished at that point, but he knew it the year before. And I actually told a Farnsworth grandson this story, which I don't think he knew, that in Schwartz's book, he describes how Farnsworth is walking down the street, and at this time, the New York World's Fair is when Sarnoff has decided he's going to put TV forward for the world. Now, Farnsworth had already done this publicly years before in Philadelphia.
Right.
But with the power and the media that Sarnoff could bring to bear, when he introduces television, that's what sticks. Farnsworth walking down the street, stops in front of a store that has numerous of these television receivers, which were fabulously expensive, looks in and sees David Sarnoff describing how he's now bringing television forward and is working as his boy, and he realizes that the medium he's created has an unbelievable potential to manipulate and lie to people.
Right.
And I think he just imploded at that point. You get the impression in the book that he just became very depressed at that point.
Farnsworth, in the early days, imagined television as a medium that would allow one to instruct and entertain and edify America.
Right.
That it would do great things for all of us as citizens and lovers of culture and so forth. And you're exactly right that in the 1939 World's Fair, we have Sarnoff, who's presenting himself as the father of television, basically using this photo op to say, you know, look what Sorkin and I have created through hard work, through investment of tens of millions of dollars,
right,
and here is the result. I offer this to all of you as an example of the future of science, the future of society, and the World's Fair, and it was a big lie. It was a big sham. But of course, people believed it because at that point, Sarnoff owned the medium,
right,
and he was able to obviously control the message.
Absolutely. I think poor Philo was never quite the same from that moment on, when he realized that he was not going to win the battle, and by God, he did not. Yes, you know, right now, before we started recording this, PBS is airing their excellent special, Ken Burns, a special in the Civil War. When you see something like that on television, you realize, or when you play in a computer monitor, which is a television, you realize what this medium can do for good. And poor Farnsworth just never envisioned the Beverly Hillbillies.
Right.
And I don't know, did you get a chance, did you go on the web and look at the Schwartz's site for this one of the most ironic things I've ever seen in my entire life?
I didn't. I saw, you're probably going to talk about Farnsworth's own appearance on television.
His only appearance on national television, 1957. He appears on The Game Show, which probably some of you are familiar with if you didn't see it when you were, you know, if you're my age. What's My Line? He comes on and stumps the panel, even though he's the inventor of television. And the worst part about it is he wins $80 and a carton of Winston's.
And he seems glad to take it, too. It's heartbreaking. He takes the money and the cigarettes, and he walks off camera, you know, smiling.
Right.
And, you know, a shell of his former self.
Right.
And you just want to cry.
Yeah. It's just... And what really gets me is Henry Morgan, who was quite a wag, quite a wit. When they reveal to the panel, Gary Moore reveals to them, this is the famous Philo T. Farnsworth, the inventor of electronic television. You can see the panel is looking just stunned. That, oh my God! And they sort of realize the gravity of the what this sort of means.
Yeah.
And Henry Morgan looks at him and says, now, you know, tell me the truth. Are you sorry?
Yeah. Making the same jokes about television that we'd make, you know, 30, 40 years later about, what it's done to our culture and how it really hasn't been used to a great extent in the ways that Farnsworth imagined as a tool for education and for sharing of the arts.
No, it certainly hasn't. But I think that... probably a good thing to a high to close on is the fact that Farnsworth himself apparently his widow, it's a shame that his widow should have been given an Emmy. They were talking about that this last Emmy this last weekend. It would have been nice to have finally honored him, but she told the story that when they landed on the moon in 1969 and the entire world watched as Neil Armstrong went down and stepped onto the lunar surface, he apparently turned to his wife, in spite of all of the headaches, the travails, the crushed dreams he'd had. He looked at her and said, "This makes it all worthwhile."
Oh, that's nice.
And I'm glad that he had that moment, you know, before he...
Because he died 2 years later.
He did, in obscurity. But, you know, I think thanks to the fact that Evan Schwartz and David Stashower and a lot of people talking about him, and the fact that they had this commemoration, I'm optimistic that he will finally, you know, be given the recognition that he's due.
There's a big statue of him in what is it, the City Hall in where is it, in Utah, Salt Lake City?
Actually, I believe that I work with a fellow who's a Mormon, like as was Farnsworth, a good Mormon kid out in the frontier, and I guess Utah, every state is entitled to have two statues in the rotunda of the Capitol, and they had Brigham Young for
of
Utah.
Course.
But they didn't have anyone else, and some high school kids researched it and said, you know, we really ought to honor Farnsworth's statue, and now he has one.
So at least Pem Farnsworth and the sisters, the children, the grandchildren, they can go to the big rotunda there and see their founding father.
Yeah, and it was neat. It was neat being in San Francisco and seeing it, having it be Philo's Day, and there were people that came and showed up for it, and it was a neat thing. Well, I think it looks like we're out of time. So we've got to take a break. We'll be back with Sean Minton to talk about sports. Dr. Andy, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Dr.
Will you come back and talk a little bit about TV? Because I think that, you know, TV is a vast subject and we've only begun to scratch the surface.
I'd be glad to come back anytime. Thanks for the invitation.
You're most welcome. You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. We'll be right back.